Hello, this is Fourth Estate, your weekly discussion panel on all things media and journalism. On the agenda this week, the Hoopla announces it's closing down, a former staffer brags about wasting Rupert Murdoch's money, and John Laws causes yet another controversy. Welcome to this week's program. I'm Rafael Garcia in the host's chair, and joining me in the panel today, Cassandra Wilkinson, president of FEI Radio, Alex McKinnon, assistant editor at Junkie.com, and on the phone, Heath Aston, federal political correspondent for SMH and The Age. Welcome, everyone.
Hi, good to be here.
And as always, if you have something to say about what we're discussing, send us a message on Twitter. Our handle is @FourthEstateAU, all letters, no numbers. We'll start with a topic that had many sad people over the last week. The news of the death of former Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser brought on tributes from both sides of politics and monopolized media coverage, or at least for a couple of days or so. Australia's 22nd Prime Minister fought for multiculturalism and founded SBS, reflecting his strong views on how Australia's migrant communities should be given a voice in media. Alex, how was the tone of the Malcolm Fraser death coverage on the whole?
I think the coverage initially was trying to find just how to cover Malcolm Fraser's political career and his later life. The hook, obviously, was that Malcolm Fraser was a fairly conservative prime minister who, after he retired from politics, kind of shifted quite sharply to the left and ended up leaving the Liberal Party, which was a kind of nice bit of trivia for anybody who didn't know. A lot of outlets ran with that, and with the Liberal Party's reaction and reactions from people who might not have supported Malcolm Fraser while he was prime minister, but who came to find something in common with him after he left politics.
Cassandra, do you think he would have been proud of the coverage as a whole?
Oh, one suspects he might have appreciated the irony of his death knocking out discussion of the Moss report, which would have prompted some discussion about the issues that he'd spent so much time trying to bring to light. I agree that it was conflicted coverage because for those of us old enough to have grown up, even in their 80s, Fraser was just shorthand for right-wing conservative. And the change that he's undergone in recent years makes his passing meaningful in a way that it would not have been 15 years ago even, let alone, 25.
Heath, did you think the release of the Moss Review was... was it ironic that that coincided with the day of the death of Malcolm Fraser?
Oh, look, I think it was more than ironic. It was a cynical attempt to take out the trash on a Friday afternoon, and what better time than under the cover of the passing of a prime minister? When Gough Whitlam passed away, everything in Canberra came to a halt, and there was nothing said for the rest of the day besides condolences for the passing of a prime minister. We had that with a Liberal prime minister, and a Liberal government seized the opportunity to put out what was a damaging report, really, on Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock. And sure enough, it was a report that would have been destined for most front pages, probably not all. Was further back in the newspapers, and obviously wasn't followed up as much as it could be by the electronic media over the weekend that was probably still preoccupied with Malcolm Fraser.
Malcolm Fraser was passionate about improving the treatment of asylum seekers by Australia, and Saturday's Sydney Morning Herald featured a full wraparound of Fraser, and half the inside front cover belonged to the reopening of the Lindt Cafe. So I think that goes back to your point, Heath, doesn't it? Do we think that Fraser himself would have wanted the Moss Review to be front and centre? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think he probably would have. Nobody would demand the front page for their passing, but he would have known that that was never going to be the case. If we have a Prime Minister, particularly one that was involved in one of the most seminal incidents in our Australian political history, passing, of course he's going to dominate the coverage. So again, the government was actually under no compulsion or deadline or date to put that out, even though that the Moss Review I'm talking about, even though they said that it had been planned and someone, a department official, was on the plane to Brisbane even before knowing about Malcolm Fraser's death. I'm not sure how that could have happened, because we found out about it about 8 o'clock in the morning, so and the press conference was at 3. But I'm sure if he was still around and you asked him, Malcolm Fraser would have said that the Moss Review should have been under more of a microscope.
Cassandra, given how passionate he was about the asylum seeker topic, how pleased do you think he would be, or he would have been these days, in regards to the representation of asylum seekers in Australian media?
Well, I'm very hesitant to assume that I know how another person would feel, particularly someone as complex as Malcolm Fraser. But he was very clear in his last years about, the difference between the liberal ideals that he felt defined the Liberal Party he joined and the conservative ideals which have come to define the Liberal Party as it stands today. And that was certainly captured in his campaign against draconian security powers as well as the refugee powers. I mean, a commitment to both freedom and civil liberties as well as freedom of movement. He seemed to have be waging a campaign to resuscitate liberal values in the liberal movement.
Alex?
It's interesting because the government has done this before. You mentioned the Lindt Cafe earlier, and during the Sydney siege, the government came under quite a bit of criticism for going ahead with the release of the MyFO report. Most other news outlets donated, blanket coverage to the Sydney siege. And Tony Abbott's rationale for releasing the MyFO report on that day, as was planned, was that things should continue as normal. But they face a lot of backlash for releasing a very important and pretty controversial report when so much of the media's attention was distracted.
You're listening to Fourth Estate with myself, Rafael Garcia, Alex McKinnon, Cassandra Wilkinson, and Heath Aston. Remember, you can join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @FourthEstateAU. Let's move on now to a topic that had a lot of people talking in the past couple of days. Former news.com.au staffer Will Colvin, son of veteran ABC reporter Mark Colvin, last week penned the story of his time with News Corp's website, news.com.au, and the story is titled "All the Ways I Wasted Rupert Murdoch's Money." In it, Will describes how news.com.au's editorial focus went from primary source interviews to sensationalism, and how his job became about recycling content and moderating comments. In response, Will decided to find out just how much he could slack off his job without getting into trouble. Cassandra, it's pretty clear that Will didn't like the focus of News Corp journalism and was perhaps angry when that encroached on news.com.au. Should he have just quit instead?
I have been finding the coverage quite interesting. It's often the case that a young person's the way that a young person deals with a situation becomes the sort of proof point for hypotheses that are posed by all manner of people for all manner of different purposes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And sometimes you remember that, kids in their 20s, the rough and tumble of life and affects them in different ways. You get angry, you get frustrated, you have bad jobs, you go through those phases of life when you're young where you go from a lot of bad jobs. And he vented, and some people thought that that was a great get square with news, and other people thought it was indicative of Generation Y's lack of work ethic. I think in the end it didn't mean that much, and turning it into something it's not, it was grist for exactly the kind of journalism that he seemed to be trying to say that he didn't want to be a part of.
Heath, we'll come to you on this one. How common is it to find other Will Colvins in newsrooms around Australia?
As in slackers?
Well, I'd say so, if that's the word you
Look,
want to describe them.
They're not as rare as hen's teeth, I can tell you that. But although I guess in the last 4, 5, 6 years, I've noticed that there's far fewer of them because you just can't get away with it anymore in the digital age where there's virtually no deadlines. The deadline is just can you get it up as soon as possible, and also the exodus of long-term staff that's left the newsrooms not quite stocked the way that they used to be. So I just thought, it was an entertaining read, and it was sort of a little look inside one person's experience inside News Corp that he obviously didn't like, but I just felt that he had a valid story there, potentially to do with the sort of the factory type conditions in some regards with this online world of churning stories over and, you know, being the author of online of a story that you had no part in actually generating by just lifting it from somewhere else. Now, that's been a huge topic in media and on Media Watch in the last few months to 12 months. So I just think that he probably had a more interesting story if he'd stuck to what he was actually doing in terms of working rather than what he was doing in terms of not working, which was slacking off and going to nightclubs and being out in pubs and stuff when he should have been or could have been back at work. So the tone of it, I guess, was always going to get up a few people's noses, particularly in the media, and you know, whether or not he said that he's happy with it and he's not looking for any work in the media and he's got enough work. So good luck to him, I guess. But it's certainly one of those mini storms that blew up for a few hours and was done to death on Twitter and whatnot, and probably we'll never hear of it again.
Alex, did he have a story?
He did, I think. And it would have been it could have been a much more interesting and valuable read, I think, if he'd focused more on the culture of, in brackets, aggregation, which is basically stealing from other people, that goes on at a lot of websites. Instead of, yeah, again, like Heath said, I racked off to the pub and took a few drugs and look how rebellious I am. Besides all that, there is a really interesting debate to be had about news websites and whether they have any value if they're just lifting stories from other places.
Mm-hmm. How common is that practice?
I would say it's pretty common. I haven't worked at any major media organizations, but given the intensity and the stress that is incumbent on everyone who works in one to get a story out first and to make sure that yours is the story that everybody sees, I imagine it's pretty rife. I would love to hear more from Will and from others, actually, about just how prevalent it is and what kind of cultures grow up around it.
Cassandra, you mentioned earlier that, you know, it's a case of a, you know, 20-year-old who decided to just sort of have a bit of a joke, you know, but I do know that you didn't, you know, mean to generalize, you know, and it's obviously not a case for us to generalize. So is this a case of, you know, he was treated like a child, therefore he decided to act like a child?
I don't know. I thought his comments on Mumbrella were reasonably thoughtful. He seems to have been, like most of the 20-year-old journalists I've worked with, extremely hardworking, very ambitious. He got put into a position in the organisation where he felt like he couldn't express himself or fulfil his ambitions anymore. And, you know, on the way out the door, tipped over a vase.
Mm.
And I think for a lot of people who wish that someone would write the inside story on the death of real journalism, it might be a disappointment that he didn't do that, but it wasn't his responsibility to do that. I think I'd love to read that story too, the one that that you guys want to read, but I also think, you know, he's entitled to be that guy who on the way out the door just kick somebody's chair over and to not have everyone define him as a person or his future career prospects because of it.
You're listening to Fourth Estate with myself, Rafael Garcia, Alex McKinnon, Cassandra Wilkinson and Heath Aston. Radio shock jock John Laws is causing controversy again for his comments on air. This time he told an 80-year-old man who had been sexually abused when he was a child that he shouldn't be a wet blanket and should go to the pub and have a lemonade. If you haven't had the chance to listen to the recording from this conversation, we'll play a short grab now. Take a listen.
Well, how old were you? You were 11 years old.
11 years of age, then, yes.
Yeah. Did you scream?
Did I what?
Did you scream?
Scream?
Yeah. Did you yell out?
Well, I don't think it was very, very funny, I can tell you.
I'm not saying it's funny. I'm saying, did you scream in fright? I didn't say, did you scream with laughter? I said, did you yell out, stop that, you bastard? Did you lash out with your fists? Did you hit him?
No, probably not.
Probably not. I see. And how many times did it happen?
It happened a few times with him.
Okay, and that's probably enough there. I guess you get the gist. This goes on for several minutes. Cassandra, what comes to your mind when you hear this interaction on radio?
I think John Laws has done an outstanding job of demonstrating to us all why people of that generation did not go to the police. I mean, he basically asked that guy how short his skirt was for 10 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Is this another case of blaming the victim, Alex?
Well, yeah, absolutely. John Laws is a huge prick, and he's been kind of intentionally provoking stuff like this to greater or lesser extents as long as he's been on air. I guess now he's just trying to stay relevant in whatever way he can.
Heath, what comes to mind when you hear this grab?
I just thought it was disappointing the way he went about that. I compare it to I think when Kyle Sandilands asked that girl the question about a sexual assault on her, whether she'd I can't remember what the exact words, but they were equally as offensive, whether she'd enjoyed it or whether she sort of said anything, or I can't remember exactly what it was, but that ranks up there with that. And it's just another reminder after that his performance on 7:30 with his Bundy and Coke in hand, that John's probably seen the best of what was a great career. But the high point of his career was, you know, back in the 60s, 70s and 80s when this sort of stuff, like the caller was saying, was swept under the carpet. He went to the police in the 1960s. John Laws appears to have been vilifying him for not lashing out, not taking up and punching whoever it was in the face. He said, you're a teenager, you should have been big by then. It just completely grated against where society has been going on these sort of things and the support that people need. Like I said, a disappointing potentially another end to we don't know when he's going to retire next, but I think it may well be a sign that the time is right again for John Laws to retire.
Mm. Cassandra, Heath mentioned that this doesn't seem to be an isolated incident. You know, he referred back to the famous or the infamous Kyle Sandilands episode as well. What sort of message does this send when it's not uncommon for us to treat those who actually speak out about sexual abuse in this manner?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it reminds us how much work feminists have had to do over the last, really hundreds of years to get rape recognised as a crime against both women and men. And, the struggle that so many activists went through for so long, to have people accept that, people didn't, there was no consent involved in an assault, whether it's, an 11-year-old kid who John Laws thinks could have fought back, or whether it's rape in marriage, or whether it's assault in a park, or whatever it is. The idea of victim blaming is something that it's really only in the last couple of decades that we've come to terms with, where police and law enforcement agencies, and to a growing extent now the media and public opinion, is beginning to shift and say, well, actually, let's examine the behaviour of the perpetrator. The victim's behaviour is actually irrelevant in this situation. But, someone like John Laws, who, as Alex said, comes from an era when things were different, reminds us how far we've come and how much further we have to go.
I think I use slightly stronger words than that, but I'll take it.
Perhaps in not so strong words, Alex, do you think that someone who was listening to the call at the time, perhaps, and had a similar experience, would they feel less inclined to come forward and speak about it?
Well, with something as potentially serious as, child sexual abuse, obviously you don't really want to speculate, but it does play into this perception, I suppose, into society's broader perception of how we deal with people who find themselves on the receiving end of assault, sexual assault, physical assault, whatever it may be. The Australia Institute released a report a few weeks ago detailing the levels of street harassment that women face just walking around, and the numbers are off the charts. I think something like 83% of women have experienced sexual assault in public at least once. And I think things like this, that kind of contempt for victims and for people who, through no fault of their own, find themselves in hugely traumatic and upsetting situations. Coming from people like John Laws, who have a huge amount of influence, we can't deny that they do, that does have real-life consequences in the world.
Heath, let's come back to you on this one. Alan Jones survived an advertiser exodus, if you like, back in 2012 when campaigners took him to task over his comments over the then PM Julia Gillard. But both are still going. So how much of an impact can something like that have?
I don't know, and I haven't heard any talk that that advertisers would be pulling out of 2SM. But then again, 2SM is not exactly up there with your Alan Joneses and 2GBs and whatever in terms of pulling the dollars from advertisers. So I'm not sure that obviously people like Alan Jones have and John Laws, in fact, have survived Cash for Comment and other different scandals. And I think it's probably not going to be enough to force any change on John Laws and the way he operates. But like I said before, it's at some level, maybe it might be a little reminder to him that it's time to just enjoy retirement. Because I mean, as Cassandra said, it's a mark of how things have changed and how if you're as been around as long as he has, then potentially time has actually passed you, overtaken you, and so. But I imagine he'll keep on keeping on.
You're listening to Fourth Estate. I'm Rafael Garcia with Alex McKinnon, Cassandra Wilkinson, and Heath Aston. Women's site The Hoopla announced they are closing down after they experienced slow growth. This is largely being blamed on a hard paywall model they initially started with. Apparently, by the time they switched over to a freemium model, it was too late. Alex, have we got the paywall formula right?
We?
As in media.
Well, there are a few different forms, I guess. The Herald lets you read 30 free articles a month. The Australian has much stricter limits in place with its content, and inexplicably the Daily Telegraph will only let you read 3 articles before they want to charge you for the wonderful things that they put out. I guess it's... no one quite knows whether or not it's working yet. The major newspapers keep their figures very close to their chest, and I don't think even they quite know whether it's going to succeed in the long term. Everyone's trying to take content that was previously free for everyone and put a price on it, and it's taken a little bit of time for people to get used to that.
Cassandra, it seems a bit unusual that at the same time that the Hoopla is closing down, there were also a few announcements about other outlets that are focusing on the female market, including one from News Corp. Where could the Hoopla have gone wrong?
I think possibly because the Hoopla wasn't focusing on the female market. It was writing great content that was written by and for women, but it wasn't a distribution system for advertising the way some content that's described as women's content is. I think Wendy Harmer's amazing. I mean, the fact is there was no and still is no formula for making money out of media in the digital age. She was one of the first entrepreneurs who went out there, took her extraordinary national profile and her advertising market with her into uncharted waters, and instead of doing something which she could have, given her popularity, doing something more mainstream, she chose to do something in keeping with her personal values, carve out a space for women, introduced us to people like Corinne Grant, who are terrific writers and who I hope will find other places to put their wares up. I think she's done an extraordinary job, and to characterize this as a failure built on poor judgment, I don't think is a fair way to look at what Wendy Harmer has achieved. And, if finally she hasn't been able to sustain this after several efforts at innovation, after being one of the few online pioneers to pay writers, and hooray for that. You know, I think she deserves to be seen as a pioneer and not a failure.
Heath, just briefly from you on this one, we only have about 30 seconds or so. Where have they gone wrong?
Well, like Cassandra says, I don't think they have gone wrong. I don't think that digital-based media offering that's lasted 4 years could really be called a failure. It's such a fast-flowing market, and we've got new entrants. You've got the Daily Mail and the Guardian and all sorts setting up, Huffington Post coming to Australia. It's a brutal, brutal game, and I think she's done well as well.
Thank you very much for that. That's it from us on Fourth Estate this week. Don't forget, you can check out all of our podcasts on the 2SER website, and you can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Thank you to our guests, Alex McKinnon from Junkie.com.
Pleasure.
Cassandra Wilkinson from FBI Radio.
Thank you.
And Heath Aston from Fairfax.
Thanks, Raf.
Thank you, Heath. I'm Rafael Garcia. We'll be back at the same time next week. Until then, have a great week.